Sometimes I think if he could just talk to her one more time. He broke off. I know it's a dangerous game to play, and I don't look back very often. But every now and then. He left his point unsaid, but I knew exactly how he felt. When I was really low, when it was all I could do not to feel sorry for myself, I played that game too. I knew I could never win, but some days, the dark days, the allure of playing, if only, was too strong to resist. At the library, I stopped Chet before he parked. Can I ask a big favor? I could really go for a Coke. There's a Runza across the street. Would you mind?
Sure, no problem. I'll hit up the drive-thru and meet you inside the library.
He pulled up near the library's main doors and let me out. Inside the library, I went right to work. Surely Reed had emailed by now. I checked our account. Thinking there must be some mistake, I refreshed the page. But no, there were no new drafts. It didn't make sense. Something must have happened. Why else would Reed be waiting this long to contact me? For one moment, I thought the worst, my imagination running wild with possibilities. Had Reed never made it to his new home? Had Danny Bilondo found him? I drew a deep, reassuring breath. No, I was overreacting. Something was wrong, I had no doubt about that, but before I started picturing the worst, I needed more information. Reed was 19 and living on his own. It seemed likely that he would have purchased a smartphone or computer by now. But maybe there had been a hitch. His funds might have been delayed. When it came to the government, nothing ran on time. I had to be patient a little longer and see what information, if any, I could wheedle out of Carmina. I doubted she knew anything, but I could try. I'd just closed the internet browser when I saw Chet walking toward me, empty-handed. He must have left the drinks in the scout. Leave it to him to obey library rules.
Did you get your book? He asked me.
I had to look it up. It's over here. I led him to the fiction shelves, pretended to scan for a specific book, then plucked one at random.
After I checked out, he said, Should we take the elevators? Here.
Seeing me lagging behind, he threaded his arm under my shoulders. I gave him a grateful smile and let him help me out to the parking lot. Inside the scout, I took a long drink of Coke. I'd tried swearing off soda as many times as my mom had attempted to give up the hard stuff, but I felt after everything I'd gone through today, I deserved a guilty pleasure. I wondered if my mom told herself the same thing, and just like that, the Coke left a bad taste in my mouth. No, I was being too hard on myself. I had nothing in common with her.
Where to now? Chet asked.
I eased back in the worn leather seat, which was unexpectedly comfortable. Surprise me. We drove through the park, stopping at the pond to feed the ducks. Chet's hair had dried, one stray curl falling idly over his forehead. I could still smell soap on his skin from when my arrival at his house had caused him to cut his shower short. It had probably taken him 10 seconds to towel off and pull on a pair of jeans before he ran downstairs to meet me. Reed had frequently made me wait in his bedroom while he got ready in the adjoining bathroom. As much as Reed resented his dad, the Army 4-star general had left his mark. General Winslow's son was rigidly clean-cut and refused to go out in public looking thrown together. It was hard to think of someone more opposite to Reed than Chet. Finding a shady bench near the water's edge, Chet tore the bread into pieces, letting me toss them at the ducks quacking frantically around our feet. One pecked my toe, and I drew my knee up with a squeal of laughter.
Carnivores, Chet said, shaking his head reproachfully. The whole lot of them.
Too late, I realized he'd slung his arm behind me. It rested on the back of the bench, impossible to ignore. My heart beat faster. Partly from irritation, I'd sworn I wouldn't let things go this far, and partly, to my great disconcert, from attraction. He smelled incredible, and those dimples, not to mention the lazy curve of his mouth. I wondered what it would feel like to kiss him. I shook my head. I was not going there. I wasn't going to cheat on Reed. And more importantly, I wasn't going to let Chet believe a lie. And that lie was me. The girl he thought he was falling for didn't exist. She was a fraud. Chet was a good guy. A great guy. He didn't deserve the deception and heartache that would come from getting involved with me. My life was screwed up enough, and if I kissed him, I was giving him false hope. I cared about him too much to give him that. The truth was, I was taking off in August, and he'd never see me again. But I wanted to kiss him. He traced the bandage holding the cut on my forehead closed. His touch made something inside me ache. Languid heat spread through my body, and it had nothing to do with the sun overhead or the wilting hot spell of its rays. I really had to stop this. If I needed more reasons, the last guy I'd kissed had had his future upended after getting involved with me. I carried my reasoning further. If I let Chet get close and Danny Bilondo found me, Chet would become collateral damage. And when it came to damage, I'd done enough. Chet, I protested. I didn't get to finish. With a hunger I didn't expect from him, he cupped my cheek and drew my face to his. He kissed me, hard and solidly. Any thought of protest deserted me. I let go of my arguments and sank into the heat of him. Yes, 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 my body screamed. I wanted this. I'd wanted it for a while, and I was done fighting it. I pushed my mouth harder to his. With a drive completely fueled by reflex, I swung deftly onto his lap, straddled his hips, and surged my fingers through that thick, silky hair. I grasped his shoulders, gratified by the cords of muscle that tightened as he drew his arms around me. Touching him only made my desire burn hotter. I kissed him recklessly, greedily. My body felt hot and alive, humming with a delicious ache. And I couldn't remember why I hadn't done this sooner. I couldn't remember anything outside of Chet and the feel of him pressed against me. His teeth nipped my lip. I tasted his breath, warm and sweet. His hand was on my thigh, running over my bare skin. My whole body jolted with pleasure. I heard giggling. I tore my mouth away from Chet's, blinking at the sunlit path behind the bench. Two small girls stood there, pointing at us and laughing behind their hands. Their eyes grew round when they saw me. They gasped and raced away. It was enough of a distraction to pull me to my senses. I climbed off Chet. I backed away. He reached to stop me, but I held up a hand. The heat was beginning to recede, and I felt ashamed. I smoothed my clothes, like I could pretend nothing had happened. We hadn't just made out. I hadn't felt his hands on me. I hadn't been overcome by hot, throbbing desire. I want to go back to Carmina's, I said. I couldn't look at him. If I did, I might run back into his arms. The way he kissed. I shut my eyes. I squeezed them hard. I wouldn't think of it. Did I hurt you? Chet asked, breathing heavily. He braced his hands on his knees and hunched his shoulders. He was trying to wrestle control of himself, too. Hurt? No, it wasn't that. Caught up in the moment, I hadn't felt any pain. Just electrifying sensation and longing. I can't do this with you.
Is there someone else?
He asked roughly. Yes.
In Tennessee?
Yes, I said again, miserably. I didn't want to lie to Chet or hurt him. I never should have kissed him. Looking at the pain on his face, I was terrified I'd ruined everything. How would I ever repair the damage? I couldn't lose Chet as a friend. The thought of enduring the summer without him filled me with a weight heavier than my shame or guilt.
Will you see him again?
I don't know, I confessed. Chet nodded slowly, but there was nothing accepting about the gesture. Behind the torment, I saw his eyes flare.
You're going to give up something with me, for a guy who's, let's face it, is probably out of your life for good?
I'm sorry. There was nothing more I could say. If I tried to explain, I'd have to tell him the truth, and I couldn't do that.
I care about you, Stella, he said huskily.
Stella. It drove the point home. Chet didn't know me. He didn't even know my real name. He sat there looking frustrated and vulnerable, cutting himself open for a girl who didn't exist. I don't want to hurt you. I want to be your friend. My voice shook a little when I said it, and Chet laughed, but the sound was bleak and humorless.
I guess we'll have to agree to disagree on that point.
He pushed off the bench and stalked to the water's edge, his hands braced stiffly on his hips. The longer he stared into the distance, the bigger the rock in my throat grew. I bit my lip, willing myself not to cry. My instinct was to be tough and coldly insensitive. I wanted to smother any hint of emotion. I longed for Estella, who'd learned to harden her heart and not care too much because of the risk of being disappointed, or worse, hurt. After the divorce, right about the time my mom started using, that's how Reed had found me. Cool, detached, distrustful, unimpressed by life. I had to find my way back there. It was the only way I knew to protect myself. Wiping my eyes on the back of my hands, I said, "Will you take me to Carmina's?" On the ride, Chet did not speak to me. He didn't turn on the radio. I knew he wasn't trying to punish me, but that's what it felt like. The awful, suffocating silence was the worst chastisement he could have given me. I wanted him to say something, anything, even if it was just to complain about the weather. If he talked to me, I would know he didn't hate me, know he was still my friend. He pulled up to a stoplight. The high, hot sun glinted off the hood of the Scout, and I could feel sweat beating at the small of my back. Waves of heat shimmered off the blacktop. It wasn't even noon, and the temperature was still climbing. I gazed out my window at the baseball diamonds. Players were running laps around the outfield. Judging by the ruddy glow in their faces and the sweat stains on their shirts, they'd been out there a while. I could only imagine how sunbaked and drained they must feel. Farther down, in the batting cages, a few players swung bats to the rhythm of the pitching machines. Only one player sat on the bench, watching his teammates from a pool of shade provided by the overhang. He methodically tossed a ball in the air, his slouched posture bored. The coach blew his whistle, and the team scrambled in from all corners. Practice was over. The bench warmer stood up, his red-gold hair gleaming like fire. He hobbled toward his truck in the parking lot, noticeably favoring his left leg. Trigger McClure, it seemed, had injured his leg. Estella. Sorry I didn't write the past 2 days. They keep us busy. There's a big banner in the cafeteria that reads, "Live, eat, sleep, and breathe baseball." No shit. Eat a cheesesteak from Lee's for me, okay? And no hooking up with other guys while I'm not around to defend what's mine. Kidding. Sorta. I don't know what I'd do without you. Reed. That night during dinner, there was a knock at the door. Carmina set down her fork and huffed a sigh of exasperation. If Roger Perkins is sniffing around here again, I'm driving to the animal shelter first thing and getting a watchdog. If I can't keep that man off my porch, maybe a pit bull will.
Knock, knock. Anybody home?
A familiar male voice drifted through the screen door, which Carmina used at night in the hope of luring a breeze inside.
Deputy Price here. I've brought a few acquaintances.
With an unfathomable look, Carmina pushed back her chair.
We're here, Deputy. Come on in.
I followed her into the hall, where, sure enough, Deputy Price stepped inside, trailed by a swarthy linebacker of a man and a woman with a helmet of thick black curly hair. Detectives Ramos and Cherry from Philadelphia PD. They'd taken my statement at the police station the night I called 911, the night I was whisked into WITSEC. Behind them, another man wiped his feet before crossing the threshold. He was lithely built, with a scholarly face that watched the world from behind wire-rimmed glasses. I couldn't remember his name, but I knew who he was. The head prosecutor handling the case against Danny Bilondo.
Hey there, Stella. Whoa, what happened to your face?
Price had been leaning forward to give my hand a shake, but stopped at the sight of me.
Looks like you got in a fight.
He aimed a worried and questioning look at Carmina.
Last night, she explained.
It happened last night. I was going to call you.
You should have.
Local boy has a temper. We're handling it.
I don't like seeing my witness black and blue.
I said we're handling it, Carmina repeated firmly.
Why don't I ring you in the morning? Price said levelly,
but there was no mistaking the displeasure flaring in his eyes.
You can explain it to me then.
Carmina nodded, but I could tell she was both annoyed by and dreading the call. I supposed as a former cop, she felt like he was questioning her ability to do her job. I felt bad that she was taking the fall for my condition, especially since none of this was her fault. Since the assault, she'd cared for me more diligently than my mom ever had. Price turned to me.
Sorry this happened, Stella. We'll make sure it doesn't happen again, okay? When I said you'd be safe here, I meant it.
His face warmed.
You've been spending time in the sun, I see, getting a tan.
I stared at him, baffled, skeptical.
Why was he making small talk? Why was he here, period?
Good to see you again, Stella, Detective Cherry said.
Her smile was pleasant, but behind it, her sharp eyes were furiously at work, sizing up me, Carmina, and the house, what she could see of it.
What are you doing here? I asked all three of them collectively. Was I in trouble? Had Danny escaped? Guessing you didn't get my message, Price said to Carmina. Message? She echoed. Haven't heard the phone ring all day. The special cell phone I gave you? I left a message on it. Said we'd be arriving tonight. I know it's a hassle, but you really need to keep the phone with you at all times.
Carmina patted her empty pockets, frowning.
Not used to carrying a mobile phone. Think I left it on the nightstand this morning.
What are you doing here? I repeated, this time addressing Price directly since he seemed to be point man for the group.
You remember Detective Cherry and Detective Ramos, he told me. And the head prosecutor, Executive Assistant District Attorney Charles Menlove.
Mr. Menlove also stepped forward to clasp my hand, but his grip was tighter and felt much more formal. He wore a thin, frog-like smile. Where's the woman from Child Services? I asked, thinking she was the only player missing from that long, harrowing night at the police station.
Didn't bring CPU. Figured Carmina could stand in for her, Price explained.
It clicked in my head. The only reason I'd needed Child Services at the police station was because my mom was too high to look out for my welfare when I met with the detectives. Instead, a woman I'd never met had been appointed to make sure I felt safe. Price said,
There have been some developments in the case. The detectives haven't been able to get a statement from your mom, but even if she decides to cooperate, the defense will, in all likelihood, discredit her testimony. They'll play it so the jury views her as unreliable.
Because she's a drug addict, I stated. Price inclined his head tactfully.
And Reed? Well, his criminal history makes his testimony iffy. People don't trust criminals.
He isn't a criminal. He made a few bad decisions, I argued. I know about the breaking and entering charge. He broke into that house on a dare. The people weren't even home. And I know about the prowling at nighttime charge. I can't believe that's even a law. So what if Reed made a couple mistakes? It doesn't change how I feel about him.
Because you know him, Price said.
Yeah, I jumped in defensively. I know his dad was harsh and authoritarian, and his approach to parenting, if you can call it that, backfired, driving Reed to rebel. If you want to point fingers, maybe you should interrogate General Winslow. Ask him how he treated his son during the 18 years Reed was forced to live under his roof. That man is an abusive sociopath. Price's mouth pinched, but he didn't respond to my accusation.
To a jury, perception is everything. They have no reason to trust Reed. Right now, you're our best shot. Remember how I told you delay is the defense's best friend? That's because over time, witnesses forget their testimony. We need to make sure yours is rock solid.
Detective Cherry and I reviewed the statement you gave us, Detective Ramos said, and we have a few follow-up questions. We want to make sure your story is airtight. We don't want the defense seeing something we overlooked.
My knees swayed a little, but I ordered myself to keep it together. Follow-up questions. I knew my story, stick to it, and I could get through this.
Why don't we sit in the kitchen? Carmina suggested. Stella can finish her meal, and I can pour the rest of you sun tea.
What was your mom's relationship with Danny Bilondo? Detective Ramos asked, flipping out the coattails of his blazer as he lowered his muscled physique into the chair across from mine.
I already told you he was her drug dealer, I said, refusing to be intimidated by his hulking size, which I was sure was his intent.
Meaning their relationship was strictly professional.
I held his gaze without blinking, but my mind raced furiously. He was digging. Why? What did he know?
If you call buying and selling drugs professional, then yes. See, we believe he was more than that. We believe he was also her boyfriend. It's our belief that they were romantic.
I blinked once, reflexively, but other than that, revealed nothing. Did Danny say that? Because we all know Danny can be trusted. He's such a great guy. I mean, it's not like he's in jail for murder or anything.
Stella, Carmina said softly, covering my hand with her own. Just the facts.
We believe the reason your mom is refusing to cooperate with us is because she's trying to protect Danny, Detective Cherry explained.
My mom's an addict. She was passed out when Danny Bilondo shot that man in our house. She isn't being uncooperative. She doesn't know anything.
Ramos flipped through the notepad in front of him.
When we asked her to tell us about that night, she said,
he licked his index finger, finding the right page,
go to hell. Those aren't the words of someone with no memory of events. Those are the words of someone who's defensive because they're hiding something.
Maybe she's tired of being pestered for information she doesn't have, I shot back.
Under the table, I wiped my palms on my shorts.
Tell us about that night, Detective Cherry murmured.
Her dark brown eyes were soft, sympathetic.
Classic, good cop.
Let's walk through it one more time.
Again? I said resentfully.
Again, Charles Menlove said.
Until now, he'd stood with his shoulder to the wall, watching the proceedings without comment.
I want to hear it again.
It was after midnight, I began. I had rehearsed these words until I knew them by heart. My story was solid. It was really late, or early, depending on how you look at it.
What time? Ballpark, Detective Cherry said gently.
I shook my head, showing them I was at a loss. I'd been out with friends. I lost track of time.
Can you give us a range? Between this hour and that, Detective Cherry urged.
I can't. I'm sorry.
She nodded.
It's okay. Keep going.
I parked on the street because I didn't want to wake my mom.
Because you broke curfew. Isn't that right? Detective Ramos clarified. You were worried you'd get in trouble if your mom heard you. You were sneaking home, but you can't remember the exact time you got home? You weren't frantically checking the clock as you drove, sweating bullets as each minute ticked by?
I didn't have a curfew. Stay calm. I was a little worried I'd wake her, but not overly. I knew there was a good chance she'd be passed out. I was right.
At 17, you were allowed to come and go as you pleased. You don't find that unusual?
He pressed. She didn't allow me to do anything, I shot back. She was completely unaware of me. When she was high, which was most of the time, the rest of the world dropped away. It didn't exist. I didn't exist. It was like we were roommates. One roof, two different lives.
I don't expect you to understand.
What happened after you got home?
Detective Cherry asked. Shutting my eyes, I let that night return to me. Every time I went back, I expected the nightmare to lose some of its grip, but that wasn't the case. I could see the past all too clearly. I remembered the squeak of rain-washed pavement beneath my shoes as I crept toward the back door. I remembered the hushed stillness of sleeping houses, the cool dampness of the night air. I let myself inside. The kitchen light didn't turn on. Same thing in the dining room. In the dark, I felt my way through the house. As I crossed in front of the library's glass doors, I saw my mom passed out in a chair. Her pills were spread on the side table. Before I could register disgust, my eyes were drawn behind her. I stared at the man's body. He'd been shot, execution style. I was too paralyzed to scream. Scuffling sounds carried in from the street outside. I turned to the window. A barrel of a man dragged a second, leaner man over to a parked Honda Civic. The man being dragged had a sack over his head. Something about him was remotely familiar, but I was too much in shock to pursue the thought. The big man shoved the other man into the Civic's trunk, then beat him with a tire iron until his chilling screams fell quiet. After closing the trunk, the big man stared at our house. His eyes glittered with something dark and disturbing. He didn't see me, but I saw him. As much as I might want to, I would never forget Danny Belando's face.
"Your mother was unconscious when you entered the library?"
Detective Ramos repeated, jolting me back to Carmina's kitchen table. "Yes."
"And the man on the floor, the man who was shot, he was dead?"
"He wasn't moving. There was blood everywhere," I said shakily.
"Did Danny Belando attempt to enter the house at that point?"
"Re-enter? No. He drove off."
"Did you see the weapon he used to shoot the man in the library?"
"No. He must have taken it with him. Why would he leave it?"
"What time did you call the police?"
"Right after Danny drove off." Ramos paged through his notes.
"Phone records show you placed the call at 3:22 a.m.
"That sounds right."
"So it's safe to assume you arrived home around 3:15 a.m., wouldn't you agree?"
"I guess."
"You see, here's where we have a problem. We have some new information, and your statement doesn't jive."
New information? That had come to light while I was in Thunder Basin? My mind reeled frantically as I tried to guess what they knew. My hands felt damp with perspiration, and I shifted in my seat. Ramos went on.
"In hopes of catching Danny Belando leaving the scene of the crime, we pored over hours of security feed obtained from cameras in the area. Banks, convenience stores, that sort of thing. We have a street cam showing your car driving through the intersection of Audubon and 8th at 2:15 a.m. That intersection is only a handful of blocks from your house. You were driving in the direction of home. It stands to reason you should have made it home closer to 2:20. And yet, you didn't call 911 for another hour."
He propped his meaty forearms on the table, his eyes locking me in their hard gaze.
"That street cam shows your car driving toward your house at 2:15, then away at 2:40. More perplexing, it shows you returning again at 3:10. That's a lot of driving. What were you doing? Where were you going?"
I stared at him. My paralysis lasted only a moment. Finding my voice, I said, "I drove to Reed's. After I saw the dead man in my house, I panicked. I didn't know what to do. My mom was passed out. She couldn't help me. So I drove to Reed's, but he wasn't home."
"You drove to Reed Winslow's?"
"Yes."
"Why didn't you mention this in your statement?"
Tears burned my eyes. I wanted to look to Carmina for help, but she hadn't been there. She couldn't tell me what to say. I didn't want to drag him into this. I wanted to protect him. "You weren't aware that Reed had just been at your house when you left to drive to his place?" Detective Cherry asked. I shook my head adamantly, blinking against the hot sting in my eyes. No, I didn't know Reed was in my bedroom that night waiting for me to get home. I didn't know he would hear gunfire downstairs and go see what was wrong. I didn't know he'd walk in on a murder scene. My voice went up an octave. Did I know my mom's drug dealer would drag him outside, shove him in the trunk of a car, and beat him with a tire iron to make him forget what he'd seen? No. Why are we going over this again? I cried. I've already told you what happened. Why are you making me relive it?
Time for a break, Carmina said in that calm yet adamant voice of hers.
Her chair scraped across the floor as she rose to her feet.
Detectives, Mr. Menlove, I know you traveled a long way to talk with Stella, but I'm calling it a night. She's had enough.
Detective Ramos dragged his hands down his face, and Detective Cherry leaned back in her chair with a sigh of defeat. It was Charles Menlove, the prosecutor, who spoke up.
Just one more question, Stella, and we'll be on our way. Can you tell me who the man in the library was? The man who was shot?
He was my mom's former dealer before Danny Bolando.
His name, by chance?
She called him the pharmacist. She and her friends did. He supplied them with painkillers, I think. Prescriptions.
Charles Menlove's eyes were sure and steady, telling me he already knew this. And what do you surmise he was doing at your house that night?
He'd fronted my mom prescriptions, and she owed him a lot of money. He came to the house demanding payment. He threatened her, roughed her up. We both saw the bruises.
A complying nod. And Danny Bolando? Where does he fit in?
Angry now, I gave him my opinion with open defiance. I think Danny Bolando showed up, saw the pharmacist assaulting his client, and shot him. Then again, I'm not the detective. Far be it from me to make sense of these mystifying, or not, clues.
Ignoring my jab, Charles Menlove said, and that's when Reed came downstairs, upon hearing gunfire.
That's right. Reed ran downstairs to see what was the matter, and Danny assaulted him, then drove him to the west side where he dumped his body on the street without any care about what might happen to him.
You seem to have your theory all worked out. I admit it's well developed. Everything explained, no loose ends. You practically handed it to us on a gold platter.
I'll put the bill in the mail, I said with withering sarcasm. That night, I lay in bed listening to the stillness of the house. The air in my room was hot and placid, but I drew the sheet under my chin, shivering. It was after midnight before I got up the nerve to open the window. I leaned my back against the wall and shut my eyes. I rested a hand on the windowsill and let the cool air wash over my clammy skin. I breathed deeply, trying to plant my feet solidly in Thunder Basin. I hadn't realized how tense I was until they, Price, Charles Menlove, and the detectives, left. When they showed up tonight, it was as if they'd brought Philly with them. The secrets I'd been running from had finally caught up with me. But the detectives were gone now, and the world was beginning to slow. I felt the wide-open spaces surrounding the farmhouse envelop me. My problems receded into the shadows, and life seemed simple again. I felt cool, sweet relief. Tonight, Thunder Basin didn't feel like a prison. It felt like a set of open doors at the end of a long, painful road, beckoning me closer. It felt like my sanctuary.
Estella. Last day of baseball camp. I'll finally be free of my roommate, and I get to see you. Can't wait.
I'm going to take a cab from the airport and stay with a friend in the city until things blow over at home.
That's right. More fighting at the Winslow residence, and I wasn't even there to start it.
I called my mom last night, and she'd been arguing with my dad. I could hear it in her voice. My dad wants her to host a party for his army buddies, but her fibromyalgia makes it hard for her to get out of bed. She's in constant pain. How's she supposed to play hostess? In the end, I know she'll do what he wants. It pisses me off that she won't stand up to him, but I have to let it go. I've waited 17 years for her to stand up to him, and look where it's gotten me. It's a weakness to care.
When you care, you have something to lose. Read.
By the following Sunday, I was feeling much better, physically. I'd been medically cleared to go back to work, and despite Carmina's insistence that I not rush things, I was ready to see the sundown again. As in all small towns, talk traveled quickly in Thunder Basin. If there was one piece of news I wanted to reach Trigger's ears, it was that I was back at work. He'd taken some skin and blood, but that was all he was getting. I wasn't going to hide in Carmina's house, living in fear of him. But since the sundown was closed Sundays, I had one more day of waiting before I donned my support hose, faux leather skirt, and camo top again. I woke first thing, beating Carmina out of bed and put a pot of coffee on. Then I showered for church. That's right, church. I hadn't seen or talked to Chet since our disastrous kiss over a week ago, and despite the proverbial expression, time was not mending my heart. With each passing day, I felt worse. I needed to know things were okay between us. I needed his friendship. I could pretend I liked him only because there was no one else around, but there was something about him, something hard to resist. He was overpoweringly masculine, yet incredibly sensitive. It was a dangerous combination. A dangerous, alluring, tempting combination. I staunchly refused to compare Chet to Reed. There was no point. I was happy with Reed. But an unwanted voice at the back of my mind whispered it was because I knew who'd win, and it wasn't who I wanted. Or was it? Despite my best-laid plans, I hadn't bumped into Chet in town, which I'd hoped would give me the perfect opportunity to gauge his feelings. Nor had I worked up the nerve to call him. I figured if I was aiming to cross paths with him, my best shot was at church. If I sat close enough to him to unavoidably run into him after the service, I'd get my excuse to talk to him. I had no doubt it would be awkward. I'd rejected him and had probably wounded his pride. He had every right to feel hurt. I just hoped. I hoped for the impossible, that things would go back to the way they'd been before. But I'd settle for saying sorry, which was another reason I was hell-bent on going to church this morning. If you couldn't make amends at church, where could you? Carmina and I rode together. Climbing out of her truck, I straightened my skirt and squared my shoulders. Here goes nothing. As we walked to the doors, we passed the marquee sign on the lawn. Forbidden fruits create many jams. Talk about a guilt trip. No one knew I'd kissed Chet, certainly not Reed, certainly not any of the congregation. But just the same, I couldn't help but glance around nervously, half expecting to see huddled groups whispering and pointing at me like I was some kind of 21st century Hester Prynne. Not that it was any of their business. Carmina seemed to see the marquee sign at the same moment and grunted her disapproval. The flashy things pastors do these days to draw in larger crowds. That sign is just plain vulgar. We should rearrange the letters, create an anagram. Create a dirty anagram. Let's see. I tapped my lip thoughtfully. If an erect bride surfs on a fried car... Oh, hush, Carmina eyed me reproachfully, but a hint of a smile touched the corners of her mouth. The expression on Pastor Lycan's face would be priceless, I said temptingly. She rolled her eyes and gave a long-suffering sigh, as if to lament having to put up with me. We reached the top of the steps, and Pastor Lycan's greeted us by shaking our hands enthusiastically. He leaned in, his hushed voice turning grave.
Stella, I was grieved to hear about what happened last week. I sincerely hope you're feeling better. Did you receive my flowers?
Yes, thank you. In fact, he'd stopped by Carmina's house twice to check on me, but luck had been on my side both days and I'd been gone. A crying shame, as Carmina would say.
I'm so relieved and delighted to see you at church this morning, he went on. I hope you enjoy the sermon. Carmina, looking lovely as ever.
With a brusque nod that acknowledged his compliment, Carmina led me inside. I waited until we were out of the pastor's range of hearing before I echoed, "Lovely as ever. Is there something you're not telling me?" "Don't be nonsensical. He was hitting on you." Carmina paused in walking to give me a stern, reproachful eye. "Of all the harebrained things to suggest." "Now I know what you do at Bible study," I said slyly. "Lord help us," Carmina muttered, sliding into an empty pew. I had just taken my seat beside her when Trigger and his parents strolled up the aisle. Trigger wore a navy-checked shirt and Dockers, and while he looked squeaky clean, I knew the dirty truth about him. He had a crutch tucked under one armpit and hobbled into a pew two in front of ours. Before easing gingerly into his seat, he looked back and caught my eye. To anyone else, his expression would have seemed perfectly impassive, but I saw the taunting gleam in his rage-filled eyes as he leered at me. In that moment, he reminded me of Danny Bilondo. They shared the same untouchable arrogance and unstable temper. I could see it as plainly in Trigger's fixated stare as I had in Danny's crazed eyes all those weeks ago. The woman seated in front of me leaned forward to speak with Trigger. "What happened, Trigger? Hurt yourself at baseball practice?" He smiled, slow and easy. "Yes, ma'am. Took a stray ball to the ankle. Doc said I got a distal fibula fracture. Fancy talk for one broken bone, so I can still walk on it. I just gotta be careful. And I gotta wear this walking cast 4 more weeks. "A shame. Were any scouts planning on watching you play this week?" "Sure, they always are. But don't you fret, Mrs. Lamb. You throw an over-the-top sinker like I do, and nobody's going anywhere. Just giving them a chance to sit back and wipe the drool off their chins, that's all." He laughed, and Mrs. Lamb joined in. I glanced sideways at Carmina, and while her gaze was fixed forward, I knew she wasn't serenely listening to the organ prelude as she appeared. At last, I drew her eyes to mine. We shared a meaningful look. She patted me on the knee. I wasn't exactly sure what the gesture was supposed to mean, but I felt a measure of solidarity. She was on my side. Chet wasn't in church, and I tried not to feel deflated as Carmina and I filed out of the chapel after the sermon. I wouldn't judge him if he'd gone out of his way to avoid me, but it didn't seem like his style. Chet was as likely to hide from me as I was to hide from Trigger. So where was he? Risking arousing Carmina's suspicion, I said, "I didn't see Chet today. Does he usually miss church?"
"Why? Something happened between the two of you?"
I should have known there was no such thing as slipping one past Carmina. I scoffed. "Of course not." Then, "What makes you think something happened?"
"You sound guilty."
Making a noise as though I were offended, I said,
"Oh,
and what do I sound guilty of?"
"Keep talking and I'll figure it out. Didn't spend 30 years honing my interrogation skills for naught."
A notable pause followed. At last, I said, "If something did happen, do you think I should go over and try to set things right?" She seemed to weigh my question.
"I don't."
"But you don't like Chet," I protested. "Of course, that's what you'd tell me. You'd like it if I never saw him again. Personal biases aside, what's the right thing to do?"
"I don't dislike Chet. That was you putting words in my mouth. I think you're looking at Thunder Basin as a pit stop on your way to something better. And I think Chet is looking for permanence. Feels wrong to encourage a relationship with no hope of catching wind in its sails."
"You're probably right," I said quietly. She had an uncanny way of seeing past the BS to the truth.
"What about the other boy?"
Her eyes were set straight ahead, but there was something perceptive and shrewd in her voice.
"I read your file. I know there was a young man in Philadelphia."
"Reed," I murmured, unsure how to deal with Carmina's directness.
Were we allowed to talk about this? I'd been ordered to stick to the cover story at all times, even with Carmina. Why was she breaking the rules?
Perhaps you're hoping Chet will help you get over him? She suggested quietly.
No, I said automatically. Did Carmina think that little of me? I wouldn't use Chet that way. Would I?
Would I admit it if I were?
Why did everything have to be so confusing?
Chet has some flaws, but he's a good, hard-working, decent boy.
Why are you telling me this?
So you believe me when I say I don't dislike him.
I felt a hot wave of guilt. You think I'll hurt him?
Chet's had a rough year since his parents' deaths. Getting involved with him is only going to end in heartache. For him, yes, but for you too. You're gone in August, and you'll have to say goodbye all over again. Was it easy the first time? I doubt it was. Chet will be stuck here for another 2 years raising that brother of his. I don't see a happy ending, Stella. And that's the truth. I think you'll hurt each other.
Why do you suddenly care about Chet's feelings? I wasn't being confrontational. I really wanted to know.
Perhaps I've blamed him for things beyond his control.
I don't understand.
I knew his father. Chet resembles him in many ways. It can be hard to remember they're two different men.
You didn't like Mr. Falconer?
Oh, it wasn't quite like that, she said with a troubled sigh. But he's gone now. What does it matter?
Her eyes looked distant and deep with grief. You really think it's best if I end things?
I do.
I grew quiet. I wasn't sure I could do that. Chet was my only friend in Thunder Basin. Without him, the summer would stretch on agonizingly long. No more teasing or silly jokes, no more softball games, since what was the point? If I was going to break away from Chet, I had to make it a clean one. I'd miss the way he looked at me, with those warm blue eyes, as if it were just me and him and the rest of the world had dropped away. I'd miss his leggy stride when we walked together. I'd even miss his stupid cowboy hat. But I didn't want to hurt him. Above all, I didn't want that.
Stella, can I talk to you? Privately?
I was tying an apron around my waist when Dixie Jo poked her head out of her office and beckoned me inside. It was my first day back at work since the attack, and one glance at her concerned expression told me exactly what this was about. I tempered my exasperation. I was fine. No one seemed to believe me, but I was. With enough arguing, I'd finally persuaded Carmina to let me return to work. The way I saw it, everything was downhill from there. I'd make Dixie Jo see she had nothing to worry about.
How are you feeling? She asked, closing the door behind us.
I know you're worried about me, but I'm ready for this. I pulled on a wide smile. Trust me, it beats sitting at Carmina's house and counting the fruit flies in the peach bowl.
I heard your doctor gave you the all clear to come back to work, she said, sounding pleased, but I could tell she wasn't convinced.
I raised my arms from my sides, dropped them back into place.
Good as new. It's okay to be scared, Stella. It's perfectly fine to want more time. Innie and Deirdre are covering your shifts, so don't worry about us. Take all the time you need, and I really mean that.
Thanks for the offer, but I'm fine, really.
That makes one of us, she said with a troubled sigh.
And at that moment, I noticed how haggard and careworn her eyes looked.
I haven't had a restful night since you were attacked. I keep asking myself, how could this have happened?
The Sundown is a family place, and I'm not just talking about our customers, but the employees, too.
We look out for each other. The idea that someone could come in here and assault one of us is...
She shook her head, looking mystified and disconcerted.
Unimaginable. Unthinkable. I'm sorry. So sorry.
She opened her arms to me, and even though I wasn't used to being hugged, I let her embrace me. I didn't want Dixie Jo to feel responsible for what Trigger did to me. She couldn't have prevented him. She kept the doors unlocked because this was a family place. We trusted each other. We felt safe here. And Trigger had taken advantage of that. She held me at arm's length. Let an old lady give you a word of advice. Sometimes it takes longer to heal here. She laid a gentle finger against her head just above her ear. Then here. She touched that same finger to her heart. Look me in the eye and tell me you're really ready to be here. I met her gaze directly. I needed this. I had to send Trigger a clear message that I wasn't going to cower in fear. Wouldn't want to be anywhere else. Still not looking entirely persuaded, she turned me by the shoulders to face the door. Then go give 'em hell. I worked hard all night, shuttling trays of food to the street and leaving a trail of happy customers in my wake. I pocketed a $5 tip from a sweet older gentleman in orange suspenders who told me my smile was the best part of his meal. It felt good to smile, and I did it often. I wanted Trigger to hear that he hadn't left any permanent scars, inside or out. If he'd hoped to break me, he'd failed. In my mind, I drew up a scorecard. Stella 1, Trigger 0. That's right, you SOB. I came out on top. At the end of the night, Deirdre took off early, leaving Innie and me to close up. Deirdre had seniority, not to mention two kids, so it didn't bother me. Innie and I worked side by side to clean and organize the kitchen for the morning crew. We refilled the salt and pepper shakers, wiped down the ketchup bottles, and swept the floors. Innie dispensed the remaining ice cream from the machine and made us cherry shakes. We went out on the back steps to drink them, not wanting to create any new spills to clean up. To the moron who laid his hands on you, Innie said, raising her malt cup in a toast. May his balls rot and fall off, and be scavenged by vultures. Tell me how you really feel. I clinked my cup to hers, then took a long pull on my straw. How's that baby of yours doing tonight? Still kicking. I wondered if Innie ever wished it would die. No one wanted to give birth to a dead baby, but then again, no one wanted to be pregnant at 16 either. Do you think the father will help out? I asked, hoping I wasn't being too nosy. I had to tread carefully. As per Dixie Joe's directive, no pity parties were allowed. Yeah, Innie answered. He'll help out financially. He's made that clear. He's taking his role as provider real serious. And he'll be at the delivery. She sounded certain, but maybe she was telling herself lies to make the idea of having a baby at 16 seem less frightening. We slurped our shakes in silence. I think I know who attacked me, I said after a beat. I told the police my suspicion, but far as I know, they haven't arrested anyone. Innie stared at me wide-eyed. How do you know who it was? I heard you never saw his face. When he was attacking me, I kicked him in the leg, hard. As he left the storeroom, I heard him limp up the stairs. So we're looking for a bad leg. I drew a deep breath, hoping my next words didn't ruin our friendship. I liked Innie and I had her back, but I also wanted to give her some much-needed perspective, even if that meant telling her something she didn't want to hear. I think Trigger beat me up. Innie thought this over. She set down her malt cup, planked her arms on her knees, and shook her head back and forth. To my relief, she didn't leap to his defense or yell at me for jumping to conclusions. Well, I'll be. Trigger is the father of your baby, isn't he? I asked cautiously. That jolted Innie out of her reverie. Her face screwed up in puzzlement. What? Seriously? Did you really just ask me that? Now, why would I willingly encourage a disgusting animal like Trigger McClure to put his genetic material into the gene pool? You ever make that suggestion a second time, I'll break your arm. And your nose, for good measure. So, he's not the father? No. She made a face, curling her lips back over her teeth like a snarling dog might. Think I'm gonna vomit now. But he always asks for you, I protested.
And when I said he might be leaving town to play in the majors, you seemed depressed.
Jealous, maybe, but not depressed. Trust me, no one wishes that hairy butt out of town more than me. Just seems unfair that a dirty butthole like him gets a ticket out, that's all. He should have to rot in this place. What good is karma if it doesn't work?
So Trigger is definitely not the father, I confirmed one last time.
Told you I'd break your arm if you asked me that again, Innie said threateningly.
Then who's the father? She gave me a look that said my attempt at snooping was a waste of time.
If my parents found out who he is, they'd kill him, but only if his own family didn't kill him first.
I said, you realize this is going to drive me crazy. She barked a laugh.
That's been my master plan all along. Drive you batty so after I have this baby, I'm not in the loony bin all by my lonesome self.
We resumed slurping our shakes. I felt dazed. I'd been so